Good morning. After a year of churn in the leadership of the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation, a new interim director is in his sixth week of his job. Today, we'll talk about the coming year of a project that's been anything but smooth. Hart's K.N. Murty joins us later this hour. And the choice to have an abortion is one of the most private for any woman. We'll talk with visiting legal scholar Carol Sanger, the author of the forthcoming book about abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in the 21st Century America. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vandercook. We're breakfasting on bugs this morning with a visit to a Kauai restaurant that has found any number of ways to prepare and serve crickets. We'll talk with Lourdes Torres of Sustainable Boost. And Honolulu Theater for Youth presents the Hawaii premiere of You and Me in the Space Between from one of Australia's most popular children's playwrights.
It's Wednesday, January 11th. That's The Conversation after this news. And welcome to The Conversation. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. Good morning, Chris Vandercook.
Good morning, Beth Ann. It's all too clear that the struggle for abortion rights is far from over, yeah?
Far from over, and maybe strengthening it in certain ways and being undermined in others.
Yeah.
We're going to talk about that this morning. Now, you know that terminating a pregnancy is one of the most personal and private actions a woman can take. It's also one of the most politically contentious. Women are often pitted against the fetus they carry. And in some states, women are legally required to have an ultrasound before termination, deepening the stigma already felt by some women who, for whatever reason, have chosen abortion. Carol Sanger is a visiting professor from Columbia University. She's teaching at the UH Law School during J-term. And her soon-to-be-published book is about abortion, terminating pregnancy in 21st century America. And she joins us this morning in our studio. Good morning. Thank you so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
There's often so much secrecy surrounding abortion. And in many cases, women feel for very good reason that they're told that they are selfish or that they are shameful for taking that course of action, and that they should be stigmatized. What happens as we move through the era of changing political climate where we have women who have been, in some cases, brought up to believe that they should be able to make a choice and now have been feeling so much more pressure to have to undergo so much more than they thought they were going to have to do to be able to take control of their lives?
There was some hope this summer that the Supreme Court handed down a case dealing with Texas legislation, which seemed to end the free reign that states have been having in passing all kinds of regulation and having to offer very little evidence as to why it was good for women. This case was called Whole Women's Health. And the concern now is that under the new administration, Whole Women's Health might, with the next appointment, be unwound, returning to the states sort of carte blanche power to do pretty much what they want in terms of regulating facilities, regulating providers, and regulating women. And the way that women are regulated is through the mechanism of what's called informed consent. Before you have an abortion, we want to make sure you understand not just that an abortion ends a pregnancy, but that it comes very close to killing a child in the language. And so when you mentioned that women have to have an ultrasound, they not only have to have an ultrasound, which sometimes is done under even without regulation, a doctor may want to know exactly how the duration of the pregnancy, but they have to be told, and this is in the language of the statute, would you like to look at your unborn child? And if they decline, they have to sign a paper saying they declined with this added little threatening touch, and this will be kept in your medical files for 5 years. So that serves no purpose other than to sort of harass the woman to make it clear she understands she didn't want to look at her child, and that's the word that's used.
for women who are hearing this and thinking, okay, but we have Roe v. Wade. Mm-hmm. The point is that all of this could be done without necessarily deconstructing Roe v. Wade.
That's right. I think that the Roe v. Wade is unlikely to be overturned. I think we're at least three Supreme Court appointments away from overturning Roe. And even then, I'm not sure it would be overturned. But it's not necessary to overturn it, because the real decimation of that case came in a 1992 case called Casey versus Planned Parenthood. And that's the one that said states may start regulating abortion from the moment of conception. And Roe had said the first 12 weeks were relatively regulation-free because abortion was such a safe procedure. The authority to regulate comes from the fact that abortion is a medical procedure. And what's happened is that many non-medical aspects of abortion have been now stuffed into the informed consent requirement. And they're all sort of premised on the fact that women don't know what they're doing. They're acting hastily, which is why we have to have in many states, 48-hour waiting period. You go to your physician. You have a pregnancy test to verify you're pregnant. You want an abortion. They say, all right, we can schedule one, but only in 48, some states up to 72 hours later. Go home and think about it to make sure this is what you really want.
Is that a paternalistic attitude toward women, or does it go beyond that?
Well, it certainly is paternalistic. But I think it does more than – I think it's certainly paternalistic in that from all the work I've done, women don't have abortions on a whim. It's an extremely – a decision that's taken very seriously, as it would have to be in our culture. Under President George W. Bush, he created and was what was called a culture of life. That was the aura that he – identified with his administration. And so having we still have a kind of culture of life. I don't think women can not deal with – I think most women today regard it as a serious decision with slight moral overtone, even though they know it's what they want to do. They know it's best for themselves and for their families.
You mentioned the word families. That brings up the idea that many of the women who are choosing abortion are, in fact, already mothers and are simply trying to make a determination of what's good for themselves and for the rest of their families. Or in some cases, a family has fallen apart and a pregnancy has occurred, or a partner may change a perspective on whether or not they want that pregnancy. That calls into question this idea of the very black and whiteness of this decision.
Yes, it does. So everyone assumes, or everyone has in their mind, the idea of who's a kind of woman or girl who would have an abortion. And certainly the courts have made clear that – state courts have made clear that there's a – it's kind of a promiscuous sex, convenient way out, shirking the responsibilities of motherhood. But in fact, it's much more complicated than that. There are pregnancies that are very much wanted, which become unwanted over time, either because a partner leaves and has no interest, or because there could be physical problems with the fetus, which make a projected life with a child with a congenital anomaly very difficult. So it's not so clear even what a wanted or unwanted pregnancy is.
And now we have an issue with Zika.
Uh-huh.
And unfortunately with Zika, yes. You may not know until you are hitting, week 24 or 25 that there really is a problem with microcephaly.
Yes. So Zika presents – Zika is, a dreadful thing that we're dealing with now. But it highlights something very interesting about abortion. States have passed laws trying to harass women, basically. And one of the – but they're very, very clever about it. So one of the new tactics has been to say to attack abortion as a discriminatory practice. And so a number of states have said – passed laws saying if you cannot choose abortion on the grounds of fetal disability – because it violates anti-discrimination, or you cannot choose abortion on the grounds of sex, or one or two have national origin. But when you talk about disability, definitely Zika, a fetus with the Zika virus is going to be severely disabled. And yet that wasn't the target that the states had. It was a kind of political move to say, look, women are not only aborting fetuses, they're aborting the most vulnerable fetuses. It's sort of further demonizing women who make that decision. And then a number of states have reduced the period of time in which you can have a legal abortion to 20 weeks. Ohio just tried to make it 6 weeks, which Governor Kasich challenged, and it turned back to 20. But you don't know whether a fetus has Zika until the 24th week. So this highlights the sort of difficulty, I'd say cruelty, of abortion regulation in a circumstance where we have great compassion for the pregnant woman.
And makes it even more complicated for a lot of women to make a decision.
Absolutely right.
Many believe should rest with her alone. I wish we had more time to talk, Professor.
Right.
Thank you so much.
It's my pleasure.
Visiting Professor Carol Sanger is a professor of law at Columbia Law School. She teaches contracts, family law, and advanced seminars concerning women's reproductive lives. And she is teaching at the UH Law School J term. A class this Friday is a public class that will happen at 5:30. Her forthcoming book about abortion, Terminating Pregnancy in 21st Century America, is due in March.
This is The Conversation on statewide member-supported Hawaii Public Radio. It's 8:15 and coming up, feasting on grillidae on Kauai. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we've got bugs on the brain, and that led us to think about a spider with a terrible reputation. It's not a native species, but it has taken up residence in Hawaii, particularly, probably, or rather as a hitchhiker, on imports from California. Females are about twice the size of males. They've been known to devour the male after mating. They don't need them after that anyway. They're able to produce eggs from the male's sperm long after it's died. Females live for about 2 years. Males die after about 2 months. Males and immature females are harmless, but adult females, well, they're something else again. Their bite is extremely toxic to humans, and if you're bitten, you should seek immediate attention. Females are black in color with a red hourglass on the belly. There's your clue. This morning, we're looking for its name. If you know, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689. And if you're first and right, you get the prize.
I'm Craig Howes from the Center for Biographical Research at the University of Hawaii at Manoa. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR Hawaii Public Radio.
For many cultures around the world, bugs make good eating. After all, insects are six-legged bundles of protein, and there are a lot of them. Through the years, people have come up with ways to make them palatable, but they haven't exactly caught on in the U.S. Lourdes Torres is the co-founder of Sustainable Boost, a restaurant and cricket farm in Lihue, Kauai, that aims to change all that with a menu that includes pancakes, desserts like ginger cookies, and main courses like salmon and potato with cricket powder fritters. She says bugs are the food of the future, and she's on the phone with us from Kauai. Good morning, Lourdes.
Good morning, and thank you for having me.
This was a very bold idea, wasn't it?
It really is, and I have been pleasantly surprised by the way my customers have responded.
So they are able to keep an open mind about what it is they're eating, yeah?
oh, they're so excited about every aspect of this crop. And I think it is really interesting to see what's happened in other areas, for example, in the organic industry.
Mm-hmm.
People more and more are becoming aware of where their food is coming from, how far it's traveling, how it's processed, what kind of ingredients and chemicals is put into it. So I believe that this is a perfect time to introduce this, what I call a forgotten crop, which is insects, right? We know we've been eating insects forever, for thousands of years.
Sure.
And so I thought I would have to deal with the ick factor that Americans have with bugs, but it hasn't happened in Kauai. And I am feeling so proud and so privileged to have launched my product here, because we are ready for it. We're ready to have a crop that is ultra sustainable. And
well, that's one of the concerns.
We can talk a little bit about that. Go ahead.
One of the concerns of the future, Lourdes, is how we're going to feed everybody, right? And we haven't come up with answers to that, but entirely. And this is a pretty good way to do it, isn't it?
Correct. That was, I dare say, my number one inspiration. I am aware and truly concerned about the population explosion. We're going to put 2 billion people on the planet in 50 years.
Yeah.
And according to people like the United Nations, we're going to have to double our food production. And we can calculate how much protein we need based on the many humans on the planet. And raising bugs is definitely a major part of that solution, how to bring enough protein and minerals and nutrients to a growing population.
You know, Lourdes, in my camping and hiking days, I used to carry around a book called How to Survive in the Woods, which is, you know, what to do if you find yourself stranded without any food sources. And the number one thing they say to you is eat bugs, right?
Yes.
They'll keep you alive.
I understand that. And grew up in my grandmother's farm in Puerto Rico,
mm-hmm.
and she taught us the value of bugs. So I think that introduction helped me and stayed with me forever, and it helped me become who I am today. So I'm curious, did you get to eat any bugs while you were out there hiking?
No, but it made me more mindful of making sure I had enough food with me when I went off
Very
hiking
good.
In the deep woods. But at the same time, you know, I remember my father traveled extensively in Africa in the 20s and 30s, and he told me all kinds of stories about people doing torchlight processions at night, which would fry the locusts who flew into the torches, and then they would pick up the locusts and have a feast.
Yes, a very healthy feast.
A very healthy feast. And I have to ask you, Lourdes, where do you get your crickets?
Okay, I have them imported. Right, and then once we have a certain amount of females and males, we let them reproduce, and we feed them an organic diet. And the great thing about insects is that they can be fed commercial waste, so that makes them even more sustainable, because
mm-hmm.
we don't have to use feed, right, chicken feed or other feed,
mm-hmm.
To raise them. And we also can use their waste and transform it into high-protein, super-quality protein to feed cattle and other, yeah.
So it sounds as if you're kind of approaching a nothing-gets-thrown-away kind of environment.
Exactly. Yes, thank you. That's a good way of putting it.
Well, so you have essentially a cricket farm, right?
Yes, sir. We have a cricket farm.
And
these are
free-range crickets, obviously.
No, that's interesting. Crickets do not like to be free. They like to be in closed, dark quarters. So that's the other thing that's really great about them in terms of their sustainability. We don't need a lot of land. You need a fraction of the water used for other protein sources. And they grow in very small spaces, and they're happy that way.
Well, do they, raised in that kind of environment with you controlling their food supply, does that change their taste at all?
What changes their taste is what we feed them,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
And that's something really critical about insects. I would love to emphasize the fact that once we blend them and turn it to powder, which is what we use to create our products,
mm-hmm.
they taste like they have a mild nutty flavor. And some people have said, oh, they taste like a sunflower seed and other nuts, but everyone is pleasantly surprised about how delicious it is, the powder. So what we were thinking is that we would take the powder and infuse everyday foods that you and I are very comfortable eating,
mm-hmm.
and introduce it to our customers. And I think that was the key, so that they're no longer worried about chewing on an actual cricket and having to swallow a live bug.
Yeah.
Now they're seeing a delicious, for example, we have a chocolate chip cookie that we also infuse with superfoods, like chia seeds, flax seeds, hemp seeds. And when you eat that chocolate chip cookie, one cookie has 8 grams of protein. So now they're seeing the value of this cookie in terms of the nutritional factor,
mm-hmm.
and they're enjoying it because it tastes delicious. So immediately all their fears and that it factor disappears, literally.
Well, by making a, essentially you're making a kind of a flour out of the crickets, right?
Correct.
Grinding them up into powder. So that really opens you up to any number of recipes, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Are you subsisting on a cricket intensive diet yourself?
I wouldn't say intensive, but I use it every single day, and I have for many years. And I have been thinking about this for a long time, and I just thought that I'm ready now, because I was able to see that Kauai is ready for a truly sustainable crop. That's one thing. And second, I see that because of how we've been transforming our views on food, right, people are eager. People really want it. So there's no stopping us now in terms of
doesn't sound
using
that way.
Insects in our diet.
Great, Lourdes. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Lourdes Torres is the co-founder of Sustainable Boost, a restaurant and cricket farm in Lihue, Kauai. You can find out more about it on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
President goes home.
Hello, Chicago!
8 years after his victory speech from Grant Park, President Obama returns to Chicago. But how has the city fared during his time in Washington? That's next time on The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International.
This morning at 9, right after The Conversation.
Accusations and countercharges at the Office of Hawaiian Affairs again mire the agency in controversy. Amid the chaos, can OHA get anything done? Civil Beat reporter Chad Blair has today's reality check. Good morning.
Good morning, Beth.
When we talked to a new board chair, Rowena Wakana, last week, she was pretty pointed in her accusations about Kamanaʻopuna crab and looked to him as being sort of like, I don't want to call him the source of all evil, but so much of it, and was clearly looking for his ouster. How is all of this affecting the morale within an agency that's supposed to be doing a lot of good work to help the Hawaiian people?
By wide agreement from the folks that I speak with, both inside OHA and outside, morale is very low, very poor. There's even concerns that a hostile work environment exist in no small part. And according to allegations, because of Chair Okana, there are people that side with Okana. There are people that side with Crabb. There are people fearful of their jobs under the new leadership, and especially as Okana is trying to force Crabb, the CEO, out of OHA. So it is, by wide acclaim, a very sensitive and frustrating situation, even as OHA is trying to embark on some pretty major plans to sort of get its act together.
Which seemed just to be eclipsed by so much of the ongoing controversies, lawsuits, and finger-pointing. Looking at the fact that they're going to have a board meeting tomorrow, which I understand right. is not going to be in an executive session.
No, although I suppose they could change that. But right now it is a public meeting, and the public can show up not only and watch, but to testify. It will also be, I believe, videotaped and broadcast.
Is there any indication that Mr. Crabb has accepted the buyout offer?
No, there isn't. And it's actually not an agenda item for tomorrow. It appears Crabb is not looking at having that done. Remember, he was just signed up for a new 3-year contract just 2 months ago. It's for $450,000. There is a process by which they have to go through Ho'oponopono and then mediation and then finally legal action to see if they can settle. The board could also see if they can get enough votes to fire him. They need 6 votes from the 9 trustees. Right now, it's 5-4 to buy out. So that is a possibility as well, but it's not, at least not right now, scheduled for tomorrow.
Has he retained any legal counsel?
He does. He has a lawyer, and you know, it's he didn't comment on contract situations. Okana did not comment at all for this story. I can tell you that Crabb hopes that the board will act on these allegations of human resource violations against Okana and wants the board to also commit to a financial plan that they've been working on. But we'll see. My guess is tomorrow will be a very interesting hearing, as Civil Beat will be there.
You know, this keeps going on and on. Some of these things that we talk about now could be headlines that we had from years and years ago.
Yeah, the story of dysfunction at OHA is not a new one. I think what's frustrating for so many people, Hawaiians and non-Hawaiians, is the desire to help Hawaiians, to benefit them. That was the purpose of OHA, and the infighting really makes that difficult. Remember, all this change happened because of an election that happened in November in which Haunani Apoliona lost her position to Kelly'i Akina, and it only takes one person to change that board, and that's the dynamic we're looking at right now.
Which keeps bringing us back to the initial question that amid all of this chaos, can OHA get anything substantive done? We'll talk more in future. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Beth Ann.
Chad Blair joins us every day from Civil Beat with a reality check. A year ago, the Honolulu Authority for Rapid Transportation announced it had collected a total of $1.63 billion from the GET surcharge, far less than projected. That scenario of shortfalls continued, and throughout 2016, the churn among leadership added to the uncertainty over how the project could continue, especially with escalating cost projections. 2016 also saw the GET surcharge extended through 2027, and late last year, the hiring of interim executive director Krishnaya Murthy, now in his job since December 5th. Man, he's on the line with us this morning. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for the time. Thank you for being here. You know, the saga about the rail, at least the basics of it, haven't changed very much in the last little while. People say they want it to go all the way to Ala Moana. There's not enough money to do it. We're watching escalating costs, and there's also the FTA recovery plan. As you've signed on now for a year, what first things can you do that might begin to change this story, given the fatigue everybody has with it?
Well, that's a great question. One of the things that I need to concentrate on as I move on with the project in my first few weeks to months is to establish the real baseline for the project as to where we are with all the work that's been done to date, and then what does it take for us to move from here to the completion, get the project to completion up to Ala Moana. So I'm in the process of establishing that baseline, and then come up with a structure, both organizationally as well as in terms of finance needed to get the project completed.
So as you do this assessment and try to figure out where we are, which has been a real moving target for those of us who have been watching this project for all the time that it's been in existence, are you seeing any clear patterns or information that you think that we should know as we're looking to also assess how this project goes forward, given the fact that so many people are going to likely be having to help pay for it and certainly help maintain it once it's built?
Great. Great question. Given the stage we are in, as you well know, right now we are almost nearing completion of the 10 miles of the project on the west side. We are pretty much aggressively going ahead with all the station construction. We just recently awarded the airport guideway and station contract. So the only big contract that is left is the civic center portion of it. So based on the contractor's actual bids and the expenditures that have been involved and the changes that we have negotiated with these contractors, we have a better handle on what today's costs are, both in terms of what we have expended as to what is needed. That's where I am, trying to use all that data that we have and use that data for the completion of the project all the way up to Alamona.
Mr. Murthy, we've seen different projections of the costs and watching these numbers become even more astronomical. Can you give us any sense of baseline of what you think these costs realistically may be?
I think the current forecast that they have come up with, it seems to be in the range of where it should be. What I'm trying to do is to validate that and to make sure they are the right numbers. So that's the process that I'm going through at this point. I brought in some experts to help me out to do that.
When you talk about numbers, I mean, we've seen projections upward of, you know, $8 billion to $9.5
billion. Well, I think one of the moving targets have been the financial costs for the project costs. So sometimes people take the project costs and leave the financial costs out of that whole total cost. So I think that's where some confusion has been. When the number $8.2 billion was talked about, the financial cost was not a part of that number. And by clarification, the new number came out. However, as I said before, I am in the process of validating and making sure those numbers are real and we can deliver the project to these costs and to a realistic schedule.
That seems to say that we've never really truly seen the total picture, you know, the financial picture of rail. Meanwhile, we're going into a legislative session. What do you expect from lawmakers in terms of rail this year? What's on your wish list?
Our wish list is that the GET tax extension gets done up to perpetuity in the current formula that we have, 9010, and that provides us the needed financial resource, local resources, to complete the project, as well as plan for extensions on either side of the line that we are building, and then have this intermodal bus rail system in place for the county and Honolulu citizens to use.
We've also heard from the budget chair of the Honolulu City Council, who was here with us yesterday, that, you know, they're also looking at, as he put it, revenue enhancements to be able to maintain the rail once it's built. How much coordination is there between the city and state, and is there enough for you?
We are working very closely with the city of Honolulu. They're being a part of our process and procedure that we are following in establishing the O&M cost as well as the budget cost for the project itself. So we have given them all the assistance they need in order to come up with a O&M budget that they need to when they take over the project for operation and maintenance. So we are together on it, and we will be together when we go in front of the legislature requesting the support of the state in completion of this project.
You've now been in your position for about 6 weeks. You signed a contract for a year. A year goes by so very quickly. of what do you have in your mind for what it is you can truly accomplish within that time period? And is that really just a first contract? Any plans for you to stay on beyond that?
I think I'll take it one by, year by year. Right now, my first initial assignment that I took on is to get this project moving in the right direction. As I said, those are the activities of which include establishing the baseline, making sure the management structure, as well as the technical core capacity of the organization is there to complete this project to the quality and standards that we said we deliver this project to. And I think that those are achievable. That's my concentration is. And hopefully with the help of the city and the state in getting the GET extension done, I think we will have a robust, aggressive program to get this done and deliver the project.
I want to thank you for the time that you were able to give us this morning and look forward to talking to you in future.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Krishnayamurti came to heart as the former executive director for transit project delivery at LA Metro. He spent 40-plus years in rail transit since his first day on December 5th. He's been meeting with key stakeholders, the mayor, the city council, HART board members, state lawmakers, and the HART staff to learn the current status of construction and finances, and no doubt we'll hear more about that later.
Aloha, I'm Karen Meyer from the Castle Performing Arts Center. Join the conversation on Twitter. Talk back to your radio at HI Conversation.
I'm Ryan Ozawa.
And I'm Bert Lum.
Today on Bite Marks Cafe, we'll explore the latest in the field of artificial intelligence and its impact on the future of work.
As machine learning and big data are leveraged to make better decisions, how does the knowledge worker of the future stay relevant?
That's today at 5 on Bite Marks Cafe.
In today's backyard quiz, we're thinking about a spider that has taken hold in Hawaii, one with a nasty bite. The adult females are the ones you have to watch out for. They're most likely to bite you if you put your hand near a web or get too near their eggs. They're easy enough to identify by the red wedge on their bellies set off against their black, shiny bodies. Their bite contains a powerful venom that can trigger pain and cramping in the stomach and back, along with nausea, headaches, tremors, and fever. You may not feel the bite until it swells up, but when symptoms appear, you're advised to seek immediate medical attention. The spiders earn their name by eating males after mating, adding insult to injury. Females live much longer than males, who only last a couple of months. This unwelcome settler to our islands is the Latrodectus mactans, better known as the Black Widow Spider.
And Eli Maioho called us and knew the answer, and will be seeing a gift from Hawaii Public Radio coming to him at his post box in Molokai. Thanks so much for playing the backyard quiz with us. And if you've got a question, you can always send it in for us to vet. Our address is talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org. It's now 8:45.
Support for the Backyard Quiz comes from Achieve 3000. The 2017 Literacy Leadership Conference and student celebrations are February 6th through 9th on Kauai, Maui, Hawaii Island, and Oahu. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Island dwellers find themselves wondering sometimes, is this all there is? You and Me and the Space Between is a play coming to Honolulu Theater for Youth about a little girl who wonders what's beyond her island's borders and then finds herself needing to call on all her resources to save it when it springs a leak. It's a play with a unique storytelling approach. Eric Johnson is its director, and he's with us this morning. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning, Chris. It's lovely to be here.
It's good to have you. What's the setup of this play? The girl lives on an island. She doesn't really know much or anything about the world beyond it, right?
Right. I'll even go one step back. This is an original world premiere play, mm-hmm. and it came about, I was working with a Tasmanian playwright, uh-huh. Finnegan Crookemeyer, and we were talking about our island communities. And he was like, yeah, well, the mainland. And I was like, oh, you guys have a mainland? And he's like, yeah, of course, Australia, you know, yeah, is our right. mainland. And so I was like, well, we have a mainland too. And we were talking about the relationship between an island community that has a larger sort of mainland and you know, yeah. just kind of what is similar about these two islands, which couldn't be culturally or climate more different. But what are the similarities there?
And it's a very specific mindset.
Yeah, it's a very island. Specific mindset. And I think young people especially are faced with, and especially in this moment in time, mm-hmm. You know, that thinking about like leaving for college or like what might it mean to leave yeah. Hawaii and go somewhere? And then also what might it mean to if you're coming from, you know, Molokai or if you're coming from, you know, we're getting so many climate refugees from across Micronesia.
Sure.
You know, what does it mean to come to Honolulu on that side of it? So to leave a small community and... anyway, so that's what Finn and I were talking about, and he's like, I think I've got a play in here. And I said, okay, let's do it. And so there's a small theater company in Tasmania and ourselves, which are both doing productions of this play,
uh-huh.
Both about an island that is in peril and goes. They think they're the only island in the world, the only land in the world, and they go off and they meet this other larger community and what happens there with that relationship? What do they keep from their own culture? What do they where is the space between these two communities? The piece is called You and Me and the Space Between. And I think that's what Finn was really writing about is for young people, but how do we engage young people in that question of what is the space between us, culture to culture, person to person, community to community, and how do we respect and honor that distance which makes us special?
Well, one of the ways you engage young people, of course, is giving them a character with whom they can identify, right? And your protagonist is a little girl, yeah?
She is. Eve is on this journey, and she ends up being the person who has the insight for how these two communities might make space for each other. She also, you know, takes the island. It's a big adventure. They, you know, pass through the seas. They meet all kinds of crazy characters along the way. And we're telling the story with all kinds of live drawing
yeah.
on stage. So the storytellers are drawing on chalkboards and making images. And we have about a literal ton and a half of sand, which is covering the stage. Finn talks about that this is a beach meets beach, right? The island literally lands on a mainland. And we have the sand to do that. And I think that is the thing that connects us, is our little beaches to beaches, communities to communities. What does that mean to bring people together?
But you're actually going to see a kind of a picture book created on stage in
right.
real time, right?
In real time. The drawing happens in real time. And one of our big challenges was how do we create the ideas of island? So often for us in Hawaii, that is connected to culture, and rightfully so, the Hawaiian culture or local culture.
Sure.
But in this time, we're taking a Tasmanian playwright. So there is no connection, and we're creating a fictitious culture and visualizing that in image and music and on stage. And then we are looking at the core issues that are facing local kids, but without the framework of local culture.
And also, one of the drivers of the plot is that her island is in peril, right? It's sprung a leak.
Right. So it's a whimsical fantasy version of sadly so much of what's happening across the Pacific and across the world that, you know, I think climate change and environmentally, we are seeing a shifting of communities, and there will be changes in populations, and populations are forced to move for political reasons, for environmental reasons. And so how do we handle those, that forced movement with compassion, with generosity? And so often, you know, we just heard in Obama's speech last night, you know, it is so often the children are young people who are first to the table with the ideas of compassion and understanding for each other. And that's exactly what happens in this story. Eve is that person, and she sees a way for these two communities to work together.
One common thread that I find in Honolulu Theater for Youth Productions is, one thing, the notion that there's much we can learn from children, that, you know, you reverse the idea that adults know more than children, and so children need to just listen. It's rather the opposite, but also the whole idea, the ability to take complex issues like the issues you just described and make them accessible to the very young.
Yes.
And have it work, to have them, you know, to see through their response that they get it.
Well, I hope that that is the case. And I hope that, you know, as we're thinking, talking to parents out there who may be worried about the world their children are entering, that part of our job that we take very seriously is, how do we engage and prepare young people to help construct our future together with us? So our job is not to protect young people. Our job is to prepare them for the world they're going to enter. And we hope that stories like this give them the fuel and the moral sort of force to go out and make a world that we all want to live in. And that's certainly what we're hoping to do with this particular production.
Yet you do see the impulse, and it's an entirely understandable one on the part of many parents, to protect, to isolate, you know, keep them away from bad news. And there's plenty of it out there, right?
Absolutely. And I think that is a very real impulse. And this is where fiction becomes so important, that we need to arm ourselves with stories that are – this story is very whimsical. It's very funny.
Yeah.
There are all kinds of, you know, antics and sort of charming elements to it that make it appealing and safe for a young person to enter the content. And that – fiction is a safe place where we can also look at some of the things that are happening in the larger conversations and larger community. And I think that arming ourselves with great literature and great story that's created right now for these young people in the day we live in is an important part of our mission kind of moving forward. And we're hoping, you know, a lot of families will become partners with us and create conversations in their community.
Well, fiction has a wonderful way of sugarcoating the pill, right?
Yeah.
You can experience both comedy and tragedy with a lack of serious consequences. You know, you know, terrible things happen, but you survive and learn from that, right?
Absolutely. I think it very much is that. And sometimes, you know, fiction, the best stories are sticky. They stay with us for generations and get passed on and become a part of our lives. And I think that for a family to share that, there's no stronger bond than for a family to have a wealth of shared stories that they can draw from to explain their experience.
Sounds as if there's more than their share in this show. Thanks a lot, Eric.
Thank you, Chris.
Eric Johnson is the director of You and Me in the Space Between, a play by Finnegan Krukemeyer from Tasmania. It opens this Friday and runs Saturdays until February 4th at Tenney Theater in downtown Honolulu. And you can find details on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page. Thank you.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Tory Richard Limited, celebrating more than 60 years of design for the island lifestyle. Tory Richard is proud to support local community news, public affairs, and talk programming on HPR.
Hi, this is DJ Mr. Nick, host of Bridging the Gap. One of the things I love about the islands and Hawaii Public Radio is diversity. At HPR, our goal is to bring you a variety of viewpoints from voices you might not have otherwise heard. Public radio lets them speak for themselves so that you can draw your own conclusions. It's smart, like you, and listener support makes it possible. Become a member today. Renew or increase your contribution at HawaiiPublicRadio.org. And thanks.
And Beth Ann, that concludes the Bugs for Breakfast edition of the conversation.
You know, when I was little, I was told that a cricket on the hearth was good luck. But from your conversation, it seems like a cricket in the hearth is not really a lucky situation for the cricket. I don't know exactly how I feel about that.
Well, there's some adaptation involved, but certainly, as Lourdes pointed out, there are a great many cultures around the world that have been eating insects for a long time, and they survive somehow, right?
And we, it's just a matter of perception and what we're used to and what we believe is food and perhaps what we think isn't.
Yeah.
But that is changing, especially with our need to provide more food for more people. Anyway,
there's
good segment.
There's
like
a picture
that
on their website of chocolate-covered crickets with their little beady eyes that would take a certain amount of adapting.
I'm just glad it wasn't Jiminy Cricket.
Yeah.
That's going to do it for us for today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to sit down with healthcare policy consultant Beth Giesting to preview the Hawaii State of Reform Health Policy Conference. And we're going to also look at the legislative priorities for Common Cause Hawaii. Executive Director Corey Tanita will be here.
And Hawaii's woodworkers will put their best work on display. We like to hear from you. You can call our talkback line and leave your comments at 808-792-8217. You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org.
If you missed any of this show or want to get another segment that you haven't heard, all you have to do is look on our conversation page on hawaiipublicradio.org and check out the archive.
I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll see you in the morning with more of The Conversation.